to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois at the Reformed Forum office. Looking forward to another excellent conversation, we trust, talking about matters in church history and even into Reformed worship. And I have with me today Dr. David C. Noe, who serves as professor of classics at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome, David. It's good to see you today.
Thanks, Camden. It's good to see you.
Yeah, we're glad that you could join us. I believe this is your first time on the program. Certainly, we've met and discussed things before, but to have you and introduce you to the viewership, so to speak, it's a true honor for me, and especially to talk about some things that we're going to be talking about today. For those of you who have been paying attention or seen recent publications, you may have seen this new book, God or Baal, Two Letters on the Reformation of Worship and Pastoral Service. These are letters written by John Calvin, but now they are translated by our guest today, David Noe, and it's published by Reformation Heritage Books. Working through this book, and I'm excited to talk about this. But even as we get started, David, I'd love for you to perhaps even talk about some of your other works just to get people up to speed, because we have, you know, several translations. You, of course, serving at Calvin and having great experience with Latin, as well as other languages, no doubt, have had the opportunity to translate other things through Reformation Heritage Books, including works by Franciscus Unius, also Theodore Beza. Could you give us just a very brief little bibliography? Because I think some people who might not have known about these might want to go pick these copies up.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. So you'll have to guide me a little bit as to how far back and how deep you want me to go, because I tend to think historically about these things. I believe it was 2013 was Franciscus Junius, the Treatise on True Theology. Mm. And this was suggested to me by a man you might know, Jonathan Beakey, who teaches at Pearson Seminary. And Jonathan said, why don't you translate this, David, because it's not, it has never been brought into English. And Richard Muller says it's really necessary as a prolegomena onto theology. Mm-hmm. And it was a providential time because I was coming up for tenure application at Calvin. And although I had done some work before, you really need one good solid project to promote your tenure application. So I jumped right on that and did most of the work in about 6 to 8 months and had a lot of help from one of my emeritus colleagues, Ken Bratt, to whom the book is dedicated. What just happened to my background here?
We got the Death Star going on. I love it.
That's my son. You know, he is also on a Zoom call now, and he needs to be scolded, I suppose. He's supposed to be doing his Latin. Anyway, so I had a lot of help in kind of getting it into its final form. So that was published, and that got some good reviews. I was very gratified by some of the folks who liked that. The late Willem van Asselt contributed to the book, as did Richard Muller. And then Richard said, you know, he has kind of been my guide through this. He said, you really should translate these two letters of Calvin, the first of which was put into English by Henry Beveridge in 1851, but the second has never been in English. So I went to RHB and I said, you know, Richard suggests this, so we should do it. Yeah. And they said, yes. Right. But then Theodore Beza intervened. I was talking to Scott Clark and I said, I really like Beza as a stylist. You know, Beza is an excellent stylist. So what do you think I should do from Beza that hasn't been done before? And Scott suggested a couple of Beza's sacramental treatises, specifically against Joachim Westphal, who was a Gymnasial Lutheran. So I translated that to a clear and simple treatise on the Lord's Supper. It was polemical work. I think that came out in 15, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I did a little bit of William Perkins for RHB. You know, it's kind of the case that if you do a couple things and they receive a little bit of success, then you start to get a lot of additional offers.
Absolutely.
So the Calvin Project, which is what we're talking about mainly today, mm-hmm. the genesis of it goes back to probably 2015, but I kind of sat idle on it for a while as I was, you know, picking more low-hanging fruit. But then I finally got the first draft finished about a year ago, went through a couple iterations and revisions, and then it came out in November, as you know.
Yeah. Well, it's tremendous. I've been really looking forward to talking about it and have been enjoying reading it. It's, you know, we'll talk about the tone and the style and, right. and all the details therein. I know people like to hear the details about the project as well, but just to provide at least a table of contents, there's an historical introduction here. There's also a word Calvin wrote, kind of an, I don't know how we would describe it, an intro kind of introduction to readers or recipients of the letter. But
yes.
then the two yep. main letters here, we must flee the forbidden rites of the wicked and maintain the purity of the Christian faith. And then mm-hmm. the second, the Christian man's obligation to fulfill or renounce the priestly offices of the papal church. And a foreword by Bruce Gordon. So,
right.
you know, you mentioned how you came to this project, but I'd love to hear a bit, you know, about the process of working on it day to day. You know, you began this roughly around 2015, but what is a typical day whenever you have opportunity to focus on it? What did that look like?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. I don't think I've talked about that publicly before. It's no secret, but it's a combination of a couple of different sorts of approaches in a way similar to how I received advice for finishing my dissertation. One advisor said, you have to do a little bit each day, no mm-hmm. matter what, and most of it will be garbage, but, you know, something will be salvageable. And I asked another advisor, you know, is that good advice? And he said, no, you can't do that. You got to set aside one day a week where you work on nothing else without distraction. And so these are competing and exclusive types of advice, right?
Yeah.
So with this, it's either I try to squeeze in 30 to 45 minutes, you know, very early in the morning, or much more commonly, very late at night. Or if I have a Saturday afternoon, or typically Thursdays when I don't teach, then I can devote 2 or 3 hours. But some of this work requires a lot of really sustained concentration. And so oftentimes the first 20 to 30 minutes of working on it is not all that productive until you can habituate yourself to the task.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I have two screens. I have, you know, one large 17-inch monitor with the PDF, thanks to PRDL and Google Books, that has digitized all of these, you know, invaluable resources that even 30 years ago, you'd have to either order microfiche or travel to these libraries in order to see them. And then on the other screen, I have Microsoft Word, and I just go back and forth and, you know, slow and steady a little bit at a time. And I don't have to look up a lot of the Latin words as to their lexical meaning,
mm-hmm.
but I often have to search around a little bit to try to catch the particular nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And this varies quite a bit by author, and even within an author by genre.
I imagine. How much does that vary even in terms of historical era? Because when we're talking about, you know, Reformed or Protestant scholastics, we're talking, you know, span of over a century, a couple centuries, and, you know.
Yeah, almost 180 years probably. Right?
Exactly. So do we find variation even mm-hmm. if we're in the same geographical region with people who are trained at same universities, right. yet there's a difference here over decades?
Yes, there's a definite difference, mm-hmm. a noticeable difference in style across across generations and even individuals. So mm-hmm. Calvin's Latin, like Philip Melanchthon and Theodore Beza, is high Renaissance Latin. It's beautiful. It's expressive. It's loaded with classical references and allusions.
Wow.
It's very beautiful. It has a kind of clarity that can be difficult to accomplish for a non-native speaker. But these men, you know, were taught Latin from about the age of 7 or 8. I think Junius started when he was 6 or 7. And of course, the particular individuals we're dealing with were geniuses in some sense, but being products of their environment, they also focused really closely on a particular skill, that is the skill of composing in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
So these early men, Beza, Calvin, Melanchthon, and I would add Peter Martyr, Vermigli, they have just the most exquisite Latin. It's really beautiful. By the time you get to the late 16th century and into the 17th, for example, I'm working on John Arrowsmith at the Westminster Assembly. You can definitely see that they are working from handbooks. That is, they know Latin really, really well, but you can kind of tell that the Latin they're giving you has been processed through a composition book, right? It's more as though they're dropping in well-worn phrases that they have been tested on repeatedly in class. Now their standard of Latinity is really, really high. You know, you could survey 500 classicists in the United States, people who teach at a high level.
Yeah.
And hardly any of them would match this, but I'm just saying it's definitely different from the earlier generation.
And that earlier generation, you have indication very clearly that they're thinking in Latin, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than
the preferred mode of communication is in Latin because it's more expressive, at least at the time, than some of the vernaculars. And of course, both Luther and Calvin contributed a great amount to their vernacular languages in terms of style and development of vocabulary.
Yeah. Wonderful. Tell us a bit about the historical context of these letters before we get into talking about the context they're in. I mean, people can ascertain from the titles that Calvin's talking about worship. He's talking about the mass. He's talking about,
right,
you know, officers and other types of protesters, Protestants within the church. What ought they to do?
Right.
Should they just protest in their hearts and then have their own interpretation of participation, whereas other people are thinking other things? But what was going on at the time? When were these letters written? And you know,
yeah. So these were published in 1537, okay. And they were written in the fall of 36, most likely. And his first edition of the Institutes came out early in the year 1536, and then that August and that fall, he's in Geneva now, beginning his first stint working with Farel and Viret. Seeking to reform the church and beginning to identify and develop his position as a pastor with no formal theological training, of course, pretty much a self-taught theologian. And then in early 1537, actually the date on the first letter is January. In fact, it might even be January 12. I don't remember. I'd have to look at the...
That's when we're recording.
Yeah, it is. Let me just look at the front of the book here. The first little introduction, John Calvin to the Pious Reader. Yes, January 12, 1537.
Some might say that's providential.
It's a strange coincidence. and so these two letters are his first real strong rebuke of two friends, Nicolas Duchemin in the first letter and Gerard Roussel, men who... whom he had known for some time and who had expressed very clear evangelical, in the 16th century sense, of course, evangelical convictions, and yet wanted to remain in the positions of privilege and power that they enjoyed within French Catholicism. And so Calvin sends out these letters and says, you know, you have to come clean, right? Come out from among them is basically his instruction.
Now, what would you say was his tone in the letters? Did they differ from one another in terms of the letters? Do you find them similar? How would you characterize it? And
right.
How might that compare to some of his other writings, not only in his time, but particularly at this time period?
Sure. Well, as Bruce Gordon says in the introduction, the tone of the second letter is much harder and stronger, sharper than that of the first. I mean, the first one is not mild, that is, to Nicolas Duchemin. But Duchemin was a much younger man, a fellow law student of Calvin's, and I think a closer friend. So imagine someone that you're close to and whom you have served with in the church. You have a growing sense of purpose and mission. You know, you've taken the same classes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then this person tells you politely, I have the same convictions, but they're not going to require of me the same kind of action.
Right.
It's going to irritate you a lot. And so the tone is very strong polemic, which of course is a genre unto itself that we can speak more of if you'd like. The second letter, that is to Gerard Roussel, is also polemic, but it's at a much higher temperature because Calvin requires a lot more of this man who was a bishop. And the occasion of the writing of the letter is his elevation to the bishopric. And the really strong insinuation is you're a sellout, right?
Yeah.
And you have chosen riches and money over your convictions, and shame on you is really what Calvin says.
Now I'm forgetting, I think it was the first man, but was it also the case that Calvin, you know, the high probability he had borrowed a significant amount of money from Duchemin
in order
to get his Institutes published? Or no,
yes.
Or was it his commentary? the sentences.
The De Clementia. That's right. Yeah. You're remembering correctly from, I'm trying to remember the footnote, but, you know, the listener, I trust, will forgive me if my facts are not quite as tight as
they're in the book.
You finish one project, right. You move on to the next, and it all sweeps away. But
right.
Yes, he had borrowed some money from Duchemin. At least I believe it's Alexander Ganashi who records that.
That's right.
The young Calvin, the biography. And the De Clementia was a failure.
He kind of wanted to become, he at least had thoughts of, it seems, you know, the next mm-hmm. great French humanist, and
yes.
needed to get that work published, which is no insignificant work, but I guess no one would take it up or couldn't find a patron. So he had to go around, he'd do it at his own expense, right. ran out of his own money, needed to borrow money from a friend. And then that seems to be in the background of him writing this a little bit more subdued polemic on worship to him.
Well, if the suggestion is that he had a special connection because he owed the man money.
No, I don't know
if that's,
it's in the background.
We should conclude.
No, no.
But I think they did probably have a much closer friendship. And, yes. You know, to use the analogy we were dealing with a moment ago, someone that you've gone to class with
right.
and says, I share your convictions, but I don't have to do what you do. That's a different kind of disappointment than someone who has been your mentor and a kind of a spiritual father, which I believe Roussel was to Calvin, or at least that's a strong possibility. The sense of betrayal, I think, is going to be much sharper with such a person.
Absolutely. No, that's helpful. I mean, it's interesting to connect these things, and that's where these letters can be useful, obviously, as historical documents, because they give us a window into relations and mm-hmm. thoughts and those sort of thing. But to connect them with information we can have from other biographies and sources, it helps us add further context, because these relationships are not just one-off or one-dimensional. We're talking mm-hmm. about Calvin's, you know, long interaction with people, even to the extent where he had borrowed money, but, you know, gone to school and trained right. and shared a life with. So that's all there in the background, which is really helpful. And the footnotes in the book are extraordinary and detailed, but I didn't find them being burdensome. Some people, you know, hear the word footnote and might not even
right.
like it, but I think that the details there for those who want it, and I think
yes.
it helps fill it out. It's very good.
Such persons, I may suggest, they should read a book by Anthony Grafton called Footnote, something yeah. like A Brief History. That's fascinating. But I want to thank, as the kids would say, I want to give a shout out to a young man named Jay DeMann. Jay DeMann is a Calvin student who, as I mentioned in the book, composed the first draft of many of these notes and mm-hmm. was really extraordinarily helpful. And I went behind then and collaborated on a lot of them, but he deserves a lot of credit there.
So, absolutely.
And I also want to blame Richard Muller at the same time, if I can, because he said, you also have to look at the French when you're doing this, you know, and like most people in my position, I have a little bit of French, but my French isn't that strong. So virtually every sentence, you know, of the Latin I compared to the French, because Richard said I should. And you can see some of that in the footnotes too. And occasionally it yields something quite interesting.
Hmm. What could you say about Calvin's Latin? You've mentioned the Renaissance style of it, but how does it compare with some of those that had gone before him, people he was
sure.
commenting on, Cicero, Seneca, those types of figures?
Right, right. Yeah, those are the key names. So, you know, there are two streams of influence, really, in Renaissance Latin. There's Cicero, and there's everybody else, right? And Erasmus actually will react against the strong Ciceronianism of the 16th century. He recognizes Cicero as the model par excellence of great Latin, but he finds that a slavish devotion to Ciceronian style is dull, right? Calvin, as Scott Manich records in his, I think it's The Company of Pastors.
Yeah, tremendous book.
I think he has a note in there that Calvin would reread all of Cicero's philosophical treatises each year. And the purpose was to keep his Latin sharp. And there's, of course, no better way to do so than by reading Cicero. But Calvin was also strongly influenced by Seneca. And the difference between Seneca's style and that of Cicero is quite profound. So Cicero is sometimes caricatured as being the master of the long sentence, right? Now, he could write very long sentences that contained a lot of hippotaxis, subordination of clause to clause, but he could also write extremely short and pointed sentences. Some Ciceronian sentences are three words long, for example, or even a single word, quid, right? Nevertheless, there's complexity in Cicero's style naturally, whereas Seneca, his style is much more pointed. I don't want to lose your listeners too much here, but the point about Calvin is that he combines these two elements to great rhetorical effect. Wow. I mean, the Latin in this book, or the English that is reflecting the Latin, this Latin is extraordinary. It's probably the hardest thing I've ever translated. It's really, really challenging.
Well, we appreciate you taking the project on, and then we can read this in a very readable English. I love it.
I hope so.
Yeah, and the style, I appreciated the English style. So that, I know. Good. I realize that that's quite a challenge. But do you agree with Ford Lewis Battle's comment that Calvin's style in De Clementia is Calvin showing off? Is that accurate?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I mentioned
he doing
that somewhere
here?
I think in the introduction, I do agree with that. That's a kind of an apocryphal statement. So Ford Lewis Battles was the teacher of my teacher, right? This is kind of my such as it is, right? Not, it's my intellectual heritage, you might say.
Yeah, sure. So
if Battles taught my teacher, Dale Cooper, who was the chaplain at Calvin College when I was a student.
Wow.
And so I inherited a lot of stories about Battles and also some of his material. And that's the one from whom I heard that comment. And I think it's quite accurate because a man, you know, in the 16th century is going to be known by his Latin style. That's how you demonstrate your ability. You know, there are no photographs, there are no recordings of being a great orator or something. The record of excellence is confined to your Latin style. And you really only have one opportunity to make a good impression, right? So Erasmus, you know, can look at a speech by someone like Melanchthon, and he can tell in 30 seconds, this man has read all of the classical corpus and he knows what he's doing. He can look at someone else, say Sebastian Castellio, and make a determination, you know, almost instantly after 15, 20 words. And so the pressure to produce good Latin, right, is extraordinarily high. And Calvin, you know, rises to the occasion and then some, I would say.
And it's not just a matter of grammar or style, so to speak, but they will often, well, maybe not often, at times use phrases from classic works. And if you hadn't read or been familiar, it's like how much Shakespeare just enters into our language in English.
That's right.
Discussing. And the same is evident there, that if you're using those phrases, it indicates your education.
Yes, that's a very good analogy, right? And a lot of the Shakespeare references that people use, like every dog has its day or something like that, oftentimes we don't even know they came from Shakespeare.
Exactly.
Right? Similarly, sometimes the phrases that men in the 16th century and a few women were using, sometimes the phrases had become really trite, right? So if you're a man like Calvin, you don't want to just drop the phrase in there.
Right.
You want to make a subtle innovation on it.
Right.
So that the reader knows it's from Cicero, but I have made it my own. Right.
It's a deep cut.
What's that?
he's providing deep cuts, you know, the stuff
deep
off
cut,
the
right.
stuff off the albums that not everyone
That's
expects.
Right,
but
right.
if you know, if you're in it and you know it, then
right.
you greatly appreciate the reference rather than just throwing
right.
out a cliche.
That's right. Everybody knows the amp goes all the way to 11, right?
Right.
Everybody knows that's Spinal Tap, but some other kind of reference from the movie
right.
constitutes a deep cut.
Precisely. That's exactly right. So speaking, you know, about the historical context here and talking about worship, I had a note here to ask about the Anabaptists and how that fit into these letters. And on that front, you know, what really do these two letters disclose about Calvin's understanding, more specifically about living as a Christian and really as an outsider in the midst of a mixed world, a mixed society,
yeah.
even a mixed church at some points?
Well, on the topic of Anabaptism, you know, I need to review my notes. I don't think they really receive, that topic receives much attention in these letters. They're almost exclusively aimed at Catholicism.
Sure.
particularly the Mass. Mm-hmm. And the issue is Calvin sees it. And of course, Carlos Eyre, who was kind enough to contribute a blurb, he wrote War Against the Idols, I think 20 to 25 years ago. As Carlos Eyre points out, the two fundamental aspects of the Reformation, I think he's right, are justification by grace alone through faith and proper worship, right? Calvin and Luther are entirely in agreement on this point, as are Beza and I would say the other men. Mm-hmm. And the first point's not so surprising maybe to Reformed men and women today. Yes, mm-hmm. justification. But the second point, that without proper worship, there's no proper church.
Right.
This is a little less familiar, but for Calvin, it's really, really crucial. Mm-hmm. And so he's getting these reports from France that his former evangelical friends have developed what he thinks is a specious justification, right? Yes, I believe in the Lutheran, you know, which is a catch-all phrase. I believe in the Lutheran understanding of justification by grace alone through faith. But what's the harm if I go to Mass? Mm-hmm. I'm not really participating. In my mind, I'm communing with the exalted Christ. I'm not partaking of his flesh and blood corporally. It's spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Calvin says you can't do that, right? You can't traffic in those two things honestly. It's just really a question of honesty.
There were folks who thought they could just go to worship at the Roman Catholic churches, partake of the Roman Catholic Mass, and as long as they thought about it differently and correctly, there wasn't really any problem with participating in that.
Right.
And Calvin, yes, absolutely denies it. It's interesting to think about Calvin's struggles here, and also to think about the historical context they're in. There's this other group called the, now I'm going to disclose my ignorance, the Mo Circle. And its efforts, or I should say prospects towards reforming worship. And then it disbanded in 1525. What was that group in the first place? And what did that mean for the context in which Calvin wrote these letters maybe a decade later?
Right. So the Mo Circle, and again, you know, readers, listeners should consult the volume, of course.
Yes.
it's a little town, I believe, northeast of Paris, not too far. And it's within the king's orbit and the orbit of the royal court. But it has a certain amount of independence. And Roussel was there. Guillaume Farel was there also. And they are reading Erasmus. They are reading, it seems, Lutheran texts, actually Luther himself. They're doing so not in order to introduce any kind of change in French ecclesiastic practice or theology, but more as an intellectual pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
They have the protection of the Queen's sister, Marguerite, and I'm trying to remember the man's name. You probably have it in your notes there. But there were a number of French aristocrats that participated in this group.
But then it eventually disbanded.
It was disbanded, yeah, by opposition from the Sorbonne, right? So the within the Sorbonne, there were a number of conservatives, like Noel Beda is the main name, B-E-D-A.
Mm.
And he was very opposed to anything that smelled of Lutheranism, right? Now, once again, as the book makes clear, Lutheran is a term that covers anyone at the time who was saying that the Bible should be read in the vernacular, that the Pope could be criticized with impunity, and that justification did not require works.
Mm.
Those are the main points.
Absolutely.
So once that circle disbanded, right,
mm-hmm.
was forcibly disbanded, and one of Calvin's associates was actually martyred not long after.
Oh, goodness.
Then those individuals dispersed to a number of different places, and Farel left, for example. Many of them went to Strasbourg, where Martin Bucer and company were just beginning their work.
You mentioned just a little while ago about the importance, not only the importance of justification by grace through faith and the commonality mm-hmm. that Calvin and Luther have on that, but Calvin as well had that significance and important understanding that the Reformation also needed to extend to worship, which is certainly the context of these two letters. But one letter, historical letter, wherein we know that, or at least I should say his desire is evidenced is in his interaction with Jacopo Sadoleto.
Right.
And there we see the fact that it's not possible for Calvin, at least for the Reformation, just to say, okay, can you hear us out? And why don't you Roman Catholics address some of our concerns and we'll come back and join the church again. Like this isn't going to happen. And while Calvin was out of town, Sadoleto wrote letters to all of his church members and whatnot, trying to subvert them and call them back to Rome and all of this other stuff. So it's an interesting historical interaction in which we see that there's no turning back, so to speak, for Calvin and those who follow after him. But I mean, I'm curious, how does that interaction, is it similar to what we have in these two letters? I mean, from a linguistic or grammatical standpoint, have you had opportunity to look at that or any other letters in Calvin's corpus that might distinguish
Calvin's,
these two?
Epistolary corpus, right, can be divided up into two broad categories, right?
Okay.
The epistolary treatises, which were meant for general consumption, and then the private letters, many of which he knew would be read by other persons, but they were aimed at only a particular audience, right?
Interesting.
So in the introduction, I include an excerpt of a letter I believe he wrote to Farrell, mm-hmm. in which he's complaining about the daily workload. I think it's Farrell. It might be Viret. And so even there, he's using a good style and flawless Latin, but it's much more rapid. It doesn't have a lot of embellishment. The epistolary treatises, this is this is an essay disguised as a letter, right? So, I mean, not unlike something like the Declaration of Independence, right? Mm-hmm. Which is actually addressed to the king in parliament, right? But they're the recipient, the ostensible recipient, but everyone is supposed to read it, right? It's for mm-hmm. a very broad audience. And so to Sadoleto, he's going to use the best Latin that he can, because of course, even in the 16th century, a common criticism was Protestants are ignorant, right? Protestants have no business dealing in these matters. It's a pretty difficult claim to make against someone like Melanchthon or Calvin, especially since many of their teachers were highly respected stylists and remained within the church. Nevertheless, when he's writing to Sadoleto, he's going to be, writing very good Latin. I haven't read the Latin of that letter. I've read it in English, but it is very similar in tone.
Sure.
And of course, polemic, right, is a genre. You know, Battles used to say, this is Apocrypha on Battles, that if you haven't written polemics, you've never really written theology, right? Mm. Because you have to be able to have ability in that register. And people who say, well, polemic is unchristian, there's some strength, maybe some legitimacy, prima facie to that argument. Battles would say, well, how are the scriptures written? Look at the things that Paul says, that John the Baptist says, that Christ says. Mm-hmm. You have to have this as part of your register.
You certainly do.
And in the 16th century, polemics is a third maybe of all theological literature, just to give a rough estimate.
Yeah, theology is borne out in those types of contexts, interacting mm-hmm. with unbelief and with error and mm-hmm. distinguishing. That's where we get so much of the precision in many ways in the scholastic era. I notice in these two letters, they're not addressed as we might think how we address letters in our common media, but they're not exactly anonymous because we could figure out who he was writing to.
Right.
But at the same time, he doesn't just slap their name and address on the top of the letter. It's written to nomen, just to.
Right.
And
that's correct.
And
anonymous.
Period. What is the purpose of that? Is just to keep them somewhat vague to those who aren't in the mix?
I think it's just plausible deniability.
Oh,
right.
I see.
So it's a kind of charity to the recipient to protect his identity. Even though, deducing the identity is not difficult.
Sure.
And we have it from two sources. We have Baze's Life of Calvin, and then Nicholas Colladin, who was one of Calvin's secretaries, confirms his point also. As to the identity of the recipients, of the respective letters. But rather than just calling them out plainly in a way that could get them into, actual mortal danger, he charitably addresses them as so-and-so, right? Mm-hmm. Dear Mr. So-and-so is kind of the idea.
Understood. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't pick up on that. I mean, I understood the anonymity, but seeing right. here the reason for that, that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. Very good. Let's speak a bit about this concept or this understanding of Nicodemism. Of course, we have the figure right. Nicodemus in the Bible, who comes to our Lord Jesus at night, inquiring, right. you know, about some deep questions and what must I do to be saved? What does it mean to be born again? That sort of mm-hmm. thing. But he does it not in public because he's a Pharisee, and that could lead to some other issues. Where did this term arise? That's the biblical background from it, but was it a term used at the time for Calvin? And if so, how was it? How did it come into play?
Yeah, so I think Calvin is responsible for coining the term. Mm. And it's a term that he used throughout his career. And like you said, John 3, right? Nicodemus is a teacher of Israel. He comes to Christ at night. And the implication has always been, not that that was the most convenient time for him,
right.
but that he did so out of fear, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a detail that the apostle includes to tell us something subtly about Nicodemus's character and commitments. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons Nicodemus is such a prime example, such a good example for what Calvin is talking about, is because later in the gospel, of course, Nicodemus owns his master when he takes Christ off the cross with Joseph of Arimathea. So the story has a happy ending, right? Here's yeah. the trajectory. You start out afraid to confess him publicly, but if you follow the whole story through, Nicodemus has come out from among them and become who he's supposed to be, right? Mm-hmm. So Calvin coins this term, and, you know, shame is probably not today considered a good motive in terms of getting people to do what they ought to. But the 16th century didn't see it that way, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Shame is a very good motive. People should be ashamed of certain kinds of behaviors. And if you bring it to the attention of the rest of the public, that can motivate them toward a proper course of action.
Yeah.
So that's what Calvin is dealing with. And he has, you know, treatises in French and in Latin throughout his career. Others pick up the same kind of language, imitating Calvin. It's an important theme in the middle 16th century.
Yeah, I mean, I was just this most recent Lord's Day was preaching from Romans 1:16-17, and that does also have the biblical theme of shame and being ashamed. Paul says, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for salvation for all who believe, the Jew first and also for the Greek." But therein Jesus speaks in Mark 8 and in all the epistles, pretty much all of them, many biblical writers, Peter, the author of Hebrews, Paul himself, speak about shame and being ashamed. And the contrast is the glory, you know, trusting in Christ and seeking after him no matter the cost, and then being received by him into glory when he returns. That is, you know, not just a pragmatic, useful motivator, but certainly something that, you know, we should not be ashamed of Christ and fidelity to him and to his word, right. No matter what that might cost us. And that's really seems to be what's at stake for Calvin's interlocutors here. They have an indifference to worship, which allows them to remain comfortable. They're not as convicted about these types of this consistency and fidelity as Calvin is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your choice of terms there when you said that seems to be what's, quote, at stake, right, is a important choice of terms because many French Protestants paid with their lives when they came out and said, we won't hide our Reformed convictions. And Calvin deals with this objection. I believe it's at the end of the second letter. I don't remember exactly, but he deals with the objections. Easy for you to say, Calvin, because you're safely lodged down there in Geneva. You don't have to face the slings and the arrows. Yeah,
exactly.
Outrageous fortune.
I think it's the end of the first letter. Yeah, he said, he's trying to answer the potential objections of the man he's writing to.
Right. Which is a common rhetorical device, right? It's classic Cicero. You anticipate the objections that your opponent might make, and then you refute them, so you get to control the terms of the objection. Mm-hmm. And Calvin just basically says, you know, I've given up what I could, and the truth does not depend upon us. It has an objective claim.
Yeah, clearly. So for Calvin here, I guess the the main point, one of the main points, certainly right there at the top, is that participation in the Romish Mass, the papal Mass, is of the same level of an error of having a complete a heretical soteriology.
Yes.
And that, I think, is so lost on so much of our contemporary church that people often treat worship as some sort of addendum, or it's an arbitrary choice, or just something that, you know, we do whatever style we like, but what the way we do it doesn't matter so much as long as your heart's right.
Right. Yes, that does seem to be an attitude that I have encountered in many places, that how we worship, even sometimes whether we worship, is mostly a subjective matter, right? That seems to be the common conviction, unfortunately, even among Reformed folks sometimes. Calvin, you know, that's not even within the ballpark for him.
Right.
It's not an option.
I'd love to ask you a few kind of maybe off-the-wall questions. I've been listening to a variety of things about pedagogy and classical education and whatnot, and just this was a reminder to me about Calvin and how different, you know, education was then than it is among the masses today. Now, I realize that there are different quarters of society that people trying to retain and recover, retrieve maybe, you know, something of the older pedagogy and classics. But since I have you here on the line to discuss, I mean, what would you love to see even in our Christian families, particularly among Reformed families, and people that are seeking to be thoughtful with in their own lives, their own education, and then in the education of their children? What would you like to see in terms of a reformation of even the way we educate and the kinds of things we, not only what we study, but how we study them?
Sure. Well, this is a really large topic that I thought a lot about, and some of my views are no doubt not just out of the mainstream, but they're probably out of the mainstream of those who are pursuing so-called classical Christian education. But you asked, so
I did.
First, right, I think that at each person who has the ability, right, so I'm choosing all my terms carefully, each person who has the ability, the opportunity, and the desire, right, those three things, should pursue a humanities education as vigorously as they can, right? So not everybody has the ability, right? We can all achieve a kind of basic literacy, I'm sure. Not everybody necessarily has the ability to read some of these authors, right? Sounds elitist, I just think it's true. Not everyone has the opportunity, right? I didn't start studying Latin until I was 20. I was never exposed to Latin or Greek. It wasn't something I knew, right? And of course, not everybody has the desire. And so I'm extremely wary of any kind of method or system that wants to prescribe in a way that, you know, could really end up curtailing Christian freedom, an optimal sort of education for everyone, right? So you send your kid to me, for example, and say, what's the best education? Well, can he or she learn Greek or Latin? Mm-hmm. Then that's what they ought to do. And they should pursue it as vigorously, you know, as they have opportunity and desire to do so. And I hope that will, you know, filter up then and bear fruit when they are adults. And so I really have my eye on, I would say, education for leaders within the church, right? The men of this generation, they took their duties so seriously when it came to being a well-educated clergy, right? Mm-hmm. They worked tirelessly. Now, as I mentioned before, some of them were, you know, some of them were geniuses, but what they shared was a culture of hard work and dedication to their studies because it would bear fruit in the church. So not to digress too much, but Calvin's typical approach, I like to tell people, for study was that he would study late into the evening, right, to 10, 11 p.m. at night. When he woke up the next morning, if he had, for example, 3 hours of study time, the first 2 hours would be entirely review of what he had learned the night before.
Interesting.
Only the third of those 3 hours would be devoted to new material. Now, the practical consequence of this was that Calvin learned things much more slowly than other people, but he forgot almost nothing, right? So the learning curve was very gradual, but he had a mastery of the material. And so, provided that, you know, people are studying the right kinds of things, and frankly, you know, they should read Cicero, Augustine, Virgil, Demosthenes, so forth, not for better English vocabulary, not to save American culture, these kinds of ideas. I have no sympathy with that. They should pursue it because it's beautiful, right? And because God has given these people gifts to produce things of extraordinary beauty. Mm-hmm. And that's a good enough reason to do so. People often ask me, what's the best way to learn Latin? And it's kind of a silly question, right? If you have a textbook that's accurate, just sit down and do it, right? Just say, I'm going to give 20 minutes to this a day until I have it or until I'm tired of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, well, how can I learn it in a year? Well, you can't. But why would you want to learn it in a year, right? I mean, why do we place these artificial kinds of constraints on things, or demand a kind of practicality from these studies that we don't demand from other things?
That, I think that's, in a sense, disclosing what is in the back of so many people's minds. Education needs to provide someone a skill to do a job to get paid,
right?
Rather than education having other, perhaps even greater purposes. Now, obviously, you know, if you're getting an education, you hope that may lead to gainful employment in various ways, but that's not the sole end or purpose of education to begin with.
So there's a man who died just about 3 weeks ago, Reginald Foster. I was not his student. He was the papal Latinist. I met him once. He's a very, very good Latinist. He says some really fine things about why one should study Latin. And it basically comes down to this, because it is one of the greatest human inventions of all time, right? And it's not divine, right? Mm-hmm. It's a human invention. But it doesn't need to be justified, right? So I ask my students in class, you know, what did you watch on Netflix last night? And what did you watch on Hulu, right? Mm-hmm. And I tell them, I like to consume some pop culture also. That's fine. But many of these things are not going to be deeply satisfying. And you never bother to tell me the rationale behind watching the NFL, right? I could ask you, why are you watching sports? You're not even participating. No one has to give an instrumental reason for, you know, listening to rock music or even classical music. It's all pure aesthetics. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to something like, you know, reading literature or philosophy, suddenly we have to come up with really mercenary reasons, and I just don't accept that
we shouldn't,
as an argument.
No, that's an important point. Some critical things to think of. We need to pick this back up, David, and talk more about some basic structures and basic principles of education. I'd love to continue the conversation. Well, let's do
remember that anything worth doing is worth doing poorly, right?
I guess so.
Right? Yeah. I mean, as a dad, Camden, I think you're a father, right?
I am. Three times over,
Yeah, you don't come home and say, you know, I was a pretty poor dad today. I'm just going to quit. Right? Right? I feel like a poor dad all the time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, often I should say, not all the time. But it's something that's good for me to do as well as an obligation. Mm-hmm. So I got to keep doing it, even if I'm not doing well, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're struggling to read Augustine in English or Latin, if you're struggling to memorize the catechism, whatever it is, who cares if you're not doing it perfectly? Mm-hmm. If it's worth doing, just persevere, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a kind of perseverance in studies beats brilliance, you know, 100 times a day.
Oh, there's how many? Yeah, we've seen so many academic careers or aspiring careers derailed for that very reason. Persistence and diligence is of utmost importance.
Right.
But we have to have our goals and our aspirations directed correctly, and of course do these things and pursue these things for the glory of God. And we see that on display with Calvin, even though he wanted to be kind of the world's greatest French humanist maybe for a time. We see that the Lord used him mightily. And we're thankful.
He wanted to replace, he wanted to be the French Erasmus, you know, he wanted to be the successor of Boudet and Lefebvre de Teppe, and he didn't succeed, but God used him for other things.
Yeah, for better things. Well, this has been tremendous. David, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Are you going to allow me to plug some of the things I'm doing online?
Do it. Oh, yeah. Tell us about it. Give us the links. I'll put them in the episode description.
All right. So for about 5 years now, I've been working on something called Latin Per Diem. And these are short 4 to 5 minute lessons on all of these authors. There's now more than 1,670 of these little 4 minute videos.
Oh, wow.
Pretty much any author you can think of, I have covered a little bit of their Latin. And if a person, you know, dedicates themselves to, say, a 2-3 year program with a notebook, just watching these, taking down notes and so forth, they can, for free, learn a tremendous amount of Latin.
Wow.
It's not spoon-fed. And, you know, in some ways, it's a little off-putting to people at first because it's just actual Latin that I'm analyzing. Mm-hmm. But it's freely there. And we've had some success. Got about a little over 3,000 YouTube subscribers.
That's great.
A couple hundred thousand views. And I thought that Reformed Forum was making too large of a footprint on the American society. So I started a podcast back in September called Ad Nauseam with a colleague of mine. Now you have to spell it with a V, A-D-N-A-V-S-E-A-M.
Oh yeah.
So it's a look at all things classical.
Yeah.
Try to keep it light, but erudite. That's kind of our catchphrase. So.
Well, this has been great. Of course, the book, God or Baal, Two Letters on the Reformation of Worship and Pastoral Service by John Calvin, translated by our guest today, David Noe. It's got a foreword by Bruce Gordon and published by Reformation Heritage Books. It's available now. We'll have links to all of those resources and all the previous books by our guest today in the episode description. But again, thanks for joining us, David. You can visit all the links online through the episode description, and you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we've got a contact page there where you can send us an email or catch us on Twitter. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.